Welcome to the McCarthy Report, the podcast where usually Rich Lowry, but today Jack Butler, discuss with Andy McCarthy the latest legal national security issues. This week, is the DOJ moving toward an indictment of Trump? What does the attack on Lee Zeldin reveal about New York's insane criminal justice system? And did the FBI shield Hunter Biden from investigation? You are, of course, listening to a Nash Review podcast. If for some reason you are not already following it or us on a streaming service, you can find us everywhere from Spotify to iTunes. And please, please give this podcast and Andy McCarthy the glowing, indeed gushing, five-star reviews that they deserve. I don't think that I really deserve them. Many of you probably don't even know who I am. I'll explain that briefly in a second. But before that, without further ado, I welcome to this very podcast through the miracle of Zoom, none other than Andy McCarthy. Hello, Andy.
Jack, how are you?
I'm all right. I just have to say, this has been a weird week for what I call the National Review Extended Universe. I mean, it seems like half of our staff is out. So there's been a real scramble in the podcasts. We have Jim Garrity hosting the editors.
I heard that.
Yeah, he did a fine job.
He sure did. And I actually think, you know, you're blurring the lines here, because as I understood it, half the staff was actually hungover. I don't know that it was
they were out. It's been a bender if they've been out all week. Goodness. we also have Dominic Pino subbing for Charlie on Mad Dogs at Englishmen. And now me, National Review Online submissions editor, hosting the McCarthy Report, which is just bewildering.
Well, you are not only welcome, we're very grateful to be able to have an episode with our fearless leader not here. So I'm looking forward to our discussion.
Yes. Do you, just for some real dip into the lore, Andy, do you remember the last time that I interviewed you?
Oh my goodness!
It was a long time ago.
Before you were with Jonah on the podcast?
Yes, it was while I was an intern for the Hugh Hewitt Show, and you were the book tour for the impeachment of Obama book.
Oh yeah.
Hugh let me interview for that because he asked me to read the book. So
I knew you doesn't read all those books.
Ah, right. He reads most of them. He is very good about that. Yeah, but yeah. Anyway,
I don't know how he gets through stuff.
He's a really quick reader. That's I think the key, and a very smart man.
But he retains stuff. Like, I'm a slow reader, which has been a lifelong problem, especially doing what I used to do, where you really have to get through stacks of stuff sometimes without enough time to do it justice. And I'm very good at retaining stuff for a while, but you actually gets through like vast amounts of stuff, and for some reason he retains it. It's there, so like when he needs it to pop out, it pops out. At least that's my experience with him.
Yeah, he's a smart man, and not just saying that because I've known him for my whole life, and he really is. But you are also a smart man, and you are a wonderful resource for National Review for many reasons, chief among which is the fact that you are capable of deciphering and penetrating these arcane legal national security matters, three of which we are going to discuss today. And we're going to start with this, the DOJ investigation of Trump heating up. But first, I just want to parse out here. Again, I'm going to approach these things as kind of the layman that I am, and you are going to explain them to me and as a proxy for the audience, what is happening. It seems to me we have... Am I right to identify here like parallel tracks? We have the DOJ investigating former President Donald Trump, and then the January 6th committee also investigating. These are separate things, but what, theoretically, the January 6th committee is like feeding things to the DOJ, or like throwing things at the DOJ to investigate further? Is that sort of the nature of that relationship?
So it's, you know, it's a very reminiscent of Watergate in the sense that you had a high-profile congressional investigation going on at the same time as a Justice Department investigation. They're separate tracks. They're conducted by separate branches of government. But the upside for the Justice Department is that because the Congress is a political body and it's not bound by not only legal rules, it's not bound by the normal protocols that the Justice Department has to go by, Congress can get away with all kinds of stuff in its investigations that the Justice Department could never get away with. So just to take one small example of something that happened recently, Pat Cipollone, who was Donald Trump's last chief White House counsel, was goaded by the January 6th committee into waiving his privileges under longtime Justice Department guidance, and potentially the Supreme Court has suggested that the that former presidents retain some quantum of executive privilege with respect to their communications. They haven't defined how broad that is, and in this particular investigation, it seems to be narrow. But at least there is a, for Cipollone, there's a potential that he could not only say that as a high-ranking presidential aide, he had immunity, complete immunity from congressional subpoena, because the framers did not want the executive branch to be beholden to Congress. So the president and his top aides are immune from congressional subpoena. They can ignore them. They don't have to. That's the Justice Department's longstanding position, by the way, based on a memo that was written about 50 years ago by William Rehnquist, who was later Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. At the time, he was the head of the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel. So I shouldn't digress too much. The point is, the Justice Department in its investigation would never have tried to compel the testimony of Cipollone, certainly without going to court and trying to litigate whether he had a privilege or not. Congress was able to goad him into it because of political pressure.
Yeah.
And what ends up happening is the committee, by using political hammer, is able to get a lot of information that the Justice Department normally wouldn't be able to get, because like Liz Cheney keeps going in front of the bright TV lights during these hearings, talking about who's taking the Fifth Amendment, who's hiding behind privilege. If the Justice Department tried to do that, a prosecutor would be brought up on disciplinary charges for flouting people's constitutional rights and legal privileges. Congress can do that because they've got complete immunity with respect to legislative activities. So what happened in Watergate, and I think what's happening here, is the committee is kind of unearthing a lot of information that the Justice Department might not ordinarily be able to get its hands on, and the Justice Department will have the benefit of that for purposes of its investigation. Whether that gets them across the finish line is a different story.
I see. So, and this is also, this would be the case even if this were a normal committee, but the sort of weird nature of the January 6th committee makes a lot of things seem more dramatic and more sexier than they might actually be in terms of the case against Trump and like Trump allies and whatnot.
Yeah, that's right. The Watergate is a contrast to that, because Nixon actually did have pretty robust defenders on the congressional Watergate investigations. There was more than one. Of course, there's the famous Irvin committee, but there were other investigations as well. Here, Trump doesn't have any. The January 6th committee is set up in a way that doesn't allow for alternative perspectives, doesn't conduct cross-examination, doesn't have anyone there who has Trump's interests or anyone else's perspective other than the committee's single-mindedly anti-Trump position. And, you know, there's a number of reasons that we've covered for why the committee ended up that way, which are probably beside the point for what you're asking, because the point is that, you know, they have this committee, which is really not conducting hearings. I always think, Jack, of hearings as kind of adversarial processes where you always get cross-examination and you always get the other side's perspective, whatever it is. And I think, you know, Liz at the end of the last hearing, did something which I thought was really disingenuous. She criticized critics of the committee who continue to say they haven't had cross-examination and the body of their work hasn't been tested. And she essentially said, Do you think someone like Bill Barr, who is emblematic of the Republican strong witnesses who were Trump people, who the committee has called as its witnesses, she said, do you think he's such a wallflower that he would have wilted under cross-examination? And of course, as Liz has to know, and as anybody who's got any experience with litigation knows, good cross-examiners don't treat every witness. In fact, they don't treat most witnesses like they're people you have to impeach and take their head off, right? If you're a lawyer and a witness is obviously telling the truth in a trial or a hearing, and you question that witness in an aggressive way as if the witness were not telling the truth, it's going to redound to the witness's benefit and you lose your credibility with the tribunal. So what a good cross-examiner tries to do is take their witness and turn him into your witness. So if you had Barr on the stand and you had a different perspective from the committees, you would bring out from Barr, for example, the fact that when the committee says a number of police officers lost their lives in connection with the riot, that's not true. And you would take him, you would take him through that. You would bring out through Barr the fact that during Trump's fiery speech on the Ellipse, he said, now we're all going to march peacefully and patriotically down to the Capitol, which is something the committee seems to think that if they don't mention that happened, maybe it will go away as a fact. So what a competent cross-examiner would do is not treat Bill Barr or the people like him like they're not telling the truth. They would bring out the facts that the committee has tried to suppress in the fact-finding process. And Liz knows that. I mean, come on. You know, that's what we're getting from this committee. So it's not really, I keep telling people, and we've talked about this a little bit on the podcast, the Justice Department, there's a lot of talk about whether the committee will make a criminal referral of Trump, which Congress can do. All that means is they recommend to the Justice Department that somebody be prosecuted based on some information that Congress has developed in the course of doing its legislative work. But what people need to understand about that is, even though it will get a lot of attention if it happens, the Justice Department won't pay any attention to it other than to give it attention. I mean, when Congress raises the profile of something, the Justice Department can't just ignore it. I mean, it could, but it'd be under a lot of political pressure not to. But in terms of whether they have a case or not, Merrick Garland and the people working with him at the Justice Department are not going to care a whit whether Jamie Raskin at the committee thinks that there's enough evidence to prove a crime. They're going to assess it in their own, not only in their own professional way of going through whether there's enough evidence to bring a charge and whether prosecutorial discretion ought to be exercised in favor of bringing a charge. They're also going to do that on the basis of information that's available to them that's not available to the committee, because the Justice Department has a number of investigative tools that are not available to Congress.
Got it. So moving on from sort of the merely procedural, as important as that stuff is, it seems that another thing that's happening here is that, kind of in the same way that the committee is generating like chum for the Justice Department, it's also spilling out into other aspects of our legal system. And so we have, at least this is my understanding of how this judge out in California, David Carter, has recently made a ruling related to John Eastman, the lawyer who ended up helping Trump in the aftermath and his challenges to the 2020 election. So could you explain how this factors in here and why suddenly this has gotten attention, this ruling by Carter, or finding, rather?
Yeah, I'm really happy you brought this up, because the committee is placing such reliance on this. So of course the media is placing a lot of reliance on it. And what I think people should understand is it's a very biased source, and it's not a very compelling opinion. And it also doesn't have anything to do, the case that it involved didn't have anything to do with whether Trump is guilty of a crime or not. So here's what happened. The committee wanted John Eastman, who was Trump's you know, main constitutional lawyer during the Stop the Steal stuff. And his name has been liberally bandied about in the committee hearings for obvious reasons. The committee wanted to get Eastman's emails with not only with Trump, but related to anything to do with January 6th, and particularly related to this idea of trying to pressure Pence into not counting electoral votes, which is basically Eastman's theory of what you could do with the Electoral Count Act here. It's a frivolous legal theory, but that was his theory, and that's what they were running with. So that's what the litigation about is about. And Eastman, because he's a lawyer who has clients, wanted to protect his client's attorney-client privilege. People should understand the attorney-client privilege belongs to the client, not the lawyer. So the lawyer can't waive it, and the lawyer has an ethical responsibility when others try to pierce the privilege, to pierce the confidentiality, the lawyer is obliged to try to protect the client's confidences. So it, really, Eastman was doing what he should have been doing by trying to block the subpoena. And the committee was doing what it should have been doing by trying to get the information. That's why we have courts to resolve all this. So the committee did not think, let me just briefly say that when you're trying to get information from a lawyer, the questions that arise are, does the attorney-client privilege apply, which goes to whether the whether what you're talking about is really communications in furtherance of getting legal advice, which is what the attorney-client privilege covers. And then even if it does cover, even if the attorney-client privilege potentially does cover what a investigator wants to get, there are exceptions to it. And the main exception is what's called the crime fraud exception, which is basically if you consult a lawyer for purposes of furthering a fraud or a potential crime, for public policy reasons, that eviscerates the privilege and the investigator is allowed to get the information. And importantly, a court which is asked to figure out whether the crime fraud exception applies is not a criminal court. So the question is not something that the judge has to decide beyond a reasonable doubt. You don't have to make a finding beyond a reasonable doubt that a crime got committed. You have to decide that it's more likely than not that a crime got committed, such that the evidentiary privilege is waived and the investigator gets the information. That's an important distinction because it shows that what was at stake in the litigation over Eastman's emails in California was not being decided as a criminal case. Trump was not a party to it. He wasn't represented by counsel. It was not a jury trial like a criminal case would be. And the judge was not applying the high criminal standard of beyond a reasonable doubt. So that's the setup. And then here's the important thing that I think people, a couple of important things that people should know. First of all, Judge Carter is a former Democratic candidate for office. He's a partisan Democrat who was put on the district court in California by President Clinton. So that's number one. Number two, when this issue first came up, the committee never cited the crime fraud exception because what they said is Eastman's emails are on a server that belongs to Chapman Law School, not to Eastman. He wasn't supposed to put them on there anyway, and that for a variety of technical reasons, the attorney-client privilege did not even apply. So the committee had no intention of going into crime fraud exception. They basically said he doesn't have a basis to keep this covered under attorney-client privilege. And after the committee staked out that position, the judge asked, well, don't you think I should evaluate this under the crime fraud exception? At which point, what was the committee's lawyer going to do? If the judge is saying, don't you have an alternative basis that you can get this information you want? Of course, the committee's lawyer is going to say, oh, yes, judge, you should absolutely look at it under the crime fraud exception. So it was Carter himself who injected the crime fraud exception into a litigation that the parties didn't think it needed to be in. And then in his opinion, Carter makes a finding that it was more probable than not that Trump and Eastman obstructed Congress and committed conspiracy to defraud the United States. And therefore, the crime fraud exception applied. And by the way, he only said it applied to one conversation. Of all the conversations that were at stake, there was one single communication that he said that this applied to. So I think this is one of these situations where you had a very political judge who reached out to say something that was provocative. His opinion is written like it's something that's made to be read, which is not usually what you find in a case like this. And he had to know that everybody on the planet would seize on it, because what the committee likes, Jack, is when they can say that some third party that is presumptively legitimate has looked at this and said Trump is committing a crime. So now they have a federal district judge. It doesn't matter who appointed him. As far as they're concerned, this is a district judge, right? And similarly, the committee very much likes that the Justice Department has indicted two sets of people for seditious conspiracy. So they can say, this isn't us saying this, this is the Justice Department. Now, if you look hard at that, what you find is the Justice Department's theory of its seditious conspiracy cases is exactly the opposite of the committee's theory of Trump. The committee says Trump is the root of all evil. He causes everything, right? The Justice Department, in its seditious conspiracy cases, says Trump has nothing to do with it. These were militias that were just using Trump as a pretext to do what they were going to do anyway, which is use force against the government. So, you know, when you look at the little details here, and again, this is why it's really tragic in a way that the committee doesn't have cross-examination and alternative perspectives. If you had competent counsel who were representing alternative perspectives, the country would know all these things. They would know the weaknesses in Judge Carter's opinion. They would know that when the Justice Department indicts a seditious conspiracy case, their theory seems to be the opposite of what the committee is driving at. But we don't know these things because the committee isn't set up that way. And that's quite intentional.
Yeah. So it seems that certain things and in certain ways, it's hard to... It seems more like a PR campaign than a legal or genuine political investigation. But the PR campaign is real, and what is happening is this is inflating the expectations of what could possibly come out of the January 6th committee. You have certain media outlets and personalities also participating in this. But then we have, from the perspective of the left, Mr. Wet Blanket Attorney General Merrick Garland, who doesn't seem to be signaling that he's going to give them what they want. And there was a memo that he recently signed that has some of them, people on the left, worried that they're not going to get their pound of flesh out of this. So could you explain, is this, what's going on with that memo?
So I really think the memo is much ado about nothing, but it was raised by Rachel Maddow. So
two Shakespeare references, by the way. We should just point that out.
Oh, yes.
Pound of flesh,
good,
much
huh?
ado about nothing. Literate podcast.
Is this mixed metaphor or mixed references? Do I get a red card for that?
I don't think so. I also think it's impossible to avoid referencing Shakespeare given how thoroughly he's permeated the English language. Many of the words of which he just created. So
very well. All right. Well, with that,
tune to the Great Books podcast for more on Shakespeare.
With that stipulation, so we have our Hamlet-like attorney general. Who I think knows that it would be a mistake to indict Trump on a flimsy case, but at the same time is quite aware that there will be mutiny on the in the Democratic base if Trump is not indicted. So that's what he's dealing with. And against that background, during Bill Barr's tenure as Attorney General, the big scandal. This seems so far, long ago and far away with the, you know, Trump era scandals. But the big scandal and controversy at the time was the fact that the FBI and the Justice Department, on a very flimsy premise, had investigated Trump for being in collusion with Russia.
And oh, yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, it's dim and distant, but there it is. So what Barr, among the things that Barr tried to reform was to make it clear that, and Barr, where Barr's coming from on this is he says the Justice Department doesn't belong in politics and we want to get politics out of the Justice Department. So you don't want the Justice Department in electoral politics unless there's clear evidence of an unambiguous crime, which Barr called a meat and potatoes crime. And what he meant by that is you don't want, like what used to happen when I was in the Southern District of New York, U.S. Attorney's Office for all those years, when, you know, they would reward lawyers for being creative. You know, like if it, being a creative, effective prosecutor was to come up with a legal theory that would capture people that Congress had no idea it was trying to capture when it wrote the criminal statute in question. You know, it was a real skill to be able to push the envelope. That's the way that was the ethos of the office. And what Barr is saying is that's probably not a good thing in any event. But in the context of interference with our electoral politics, we don't want the incumbent administration, which really runs the Justice Department, to be perceived as using law enforcement as a political weapon. So unless it's very clear that a president has committed a crime that cries out to be prosecuted, we don't want the Justice Department to, Justice Department shouldn't indict, shouldn't get involved in politics. So in furtherance of that idea, Barr wrote a memo which basically imposed a new standard in the Justice Department that says if you're going to investigate a presidential candidate or a president who is in the political electoral context, there has to be high-level sign-offs, including the attorney general himself has to sign off allowing the investigation to go forward. Otherwise, we don't want political interference in the election. And when Garland came in, Garland said, well, you know, that's a good idea. I agree with that. So he basically reauthorized or reaffirmed Barr's guidance. So nothing has changed on the basis of Garland doing that, because anybody who thought that some office, some United States Attorney's office someplace was going to indict Donald Trump without like running it past Merrick Garland before they did it, that would be crazy, right? So that was never going to happen. So I really think that, you know, they got themselves all whipped up because there is this memo. But the memo just says something that's common sense and that was going to happen anyway, which is if anybody thinks they have enough evidence to indict Trump, they're going to have to get the attorney general to bless it. And that was going to happen anyway. But of course, the fact that Garland had signed this memo, which I think he did in May, if I'm remembering this right, that got Rachel Maddow all whipped up, and it got a number of commentators on the left, and not just on the left, all whipped up. So what ended up happening was Lisa Monaco, who's the deputy attorney general, instantly came out and said, you know, look, we're conducting an aggressive investigation. We don't have any predisposition about it, and let the chips fall where they may. And in recent days, Garland has basically come out and said the same thing. And I think the other thing that's happened, Jack, is there've been a couple of performative things that have happened. I regard them as more performative than law enforcement. Like, for example, Eastman and another lawyer, Jeffrey Clark, the Justice Department wanted information from them. And what you would normally do in a case of a nonviolent crime where you're dealing with lawyers as suspects and they're represented by counsel is you would issue a grand jury subpoena and you would tell their lawyers, here's what we want, surrender it to the FBI by X date. But what the Justice Department did instead was it went to the district court and got search warrants. And then it sent the FBI first to Clark's home in Northern Virginia, where they tossed his house for 3 hours, had him sitting out on the sidewalk, apparently in his pajamas. They showed up at 7 o'clock in the morning and told him to, you know, he had to get out of the house while they searched it. And they took all his computers and communications devices away. And then that evening in New Mexico, they braced John Eastman as he came out of a restaurant, detained him briefly and took his cell phone. Now, they didn't need to do that. That it was complete overkill to do that. But I think what they're trying to do is signal to the crazies that no, we haven't said no, that we're not going to indict Trump. We're taking this very seriously. Look how aggressively we're investigating this. I think it's a mistake for the Justice Department to do stuff like that, because it's not like the left, who badly wants Trump indicted, it's not like they're going to say, oh, well, if they roughed up Eastman and Clark, that must mean they're taking this very seriously, so we can calm down now. This just whets their appetite. They want this guy indicted.
Yeah.
So it's just going to ratchet up more pressure. And I really think the problem here is, you know, just to cut to the chase, they don't have a case that Trump was involved in a violent crime. They don't have evidence that he's in a conspiracy to riot at the Capitol. And I know this is impossible for people to do, but I'm going to suggest that people do it anyway. Try to imagine what you would think about the Stop the Steal scheme if the riot had not happened. If the riot had not happened, we would never be talking about indicting Trump over Stop the Steal.
Yeah.
Stop the Steal had no chance of working. It was failing. The Constitution easily withstood it. There was no, I really believe that the Republicans in Congress who idiotically supported Stop the Steal did it because they knew it was a freebie. The votes were not there to actually exclude any electoral votes. So what these people were trying to do was appeal to the Trump base, because they're hoping to inherit that support. But they knew they wouldn't win. I mean, Ted Cruz knew that there was not going to be a 10-day delay while the states audited the votes. And all these guys in Congress knew that they didn't have the votes to get any of the states' electoral votes discounted. This was all just theater.
And you think also this fake electors scheme that's suddenly getting attention, also just a red herring, no chance?
There's one way that it may not be a red herring, and that is if anybody signed a certification that was false, saying that they were a certified body of electors. But here's how I understand this worked, and this is very important to the case that, or the investigation that's now ongoing in Fulton County in Georgia. What happened in Georgia was the electors were subpoenaed by the district attorney in Fulton County, who Fannie Willis is her name, and she's the one who's running this investigation. And they were told that they were just subjects, they were just witnesses in the investigation, that they were not targets, they were not subjects. Why is that? Why were they not suspects? Well, because what they say is Eastman and Giuliani basically come to them in early December, and they say, look, we're in court in Georgia trying to get the election overturned. You know, we've cited a variety of things we say are voting irregularities, and we're in the courts of Georgia trying to win and trying to get the election thrown out. But it will all be for naught if December 14th comes and goes and there's no alternative slate of electors for Trump. Because even if we win, by then, the Electoral College will have voted and Georgia's votes will be gone. So we have to have an alternative slate of electors for Trump. So what we're talking about here are the people who were going to be the slate of electors for Trump if Trump won the election in Georgia, which he lost by 12,000 votes. So what these people did was they said, okay, we're willing to be the slate of electors for Trump contingently, and the contingency was that the Trump campaign win the litigation in Georgia. And their idea was, if Trump lost the litigation in Georgia, which he did, then the contingency wouldn't happen and the whole thing would fold. So now, flash forward a couple of weeks later in December, apparently when they were brainstorming about how to try to get Pence not to count the electoral votes, what Eastman and others may have suggested was that Pence could rely on these contingent arrangements that they had with these electors to count them instead of the state-certified Biden slates of electors in the final electoral tally. And what the voter, what the so-called fake electors in Georgia are now saying is, look, if Trump and Eastman and Giuliani and the rest of them put their little heads together and came up with this stupid scheme a couple of weeks later, that's not our fault. We just said, look, we're here on the contingency that if you win the litigation, we're ready to step in. But we didn't conspire to like defraud the country. What we said was, if he wins the litigation, you know, we're here. The reason I lay all that out is, if it turns out that people signed false documents saying that they were a certified panel and they submitted those to Congress, those would be false statements and there could be a problem. But other than that, I don't see this cockamamie fake electors scheme going anywhere, because everybody knew that they weren't certified. And under federal law, there was a deadline for the federal government to have any problem with the state certification process. It was December 8th. It's supposed to be about a week before the Electoral College meets. So once December 8th came and went, if the states had certified their slates of electors at that point, as a matter of federal law, that's conclusive. And then what happens on the 14th is the Electoral College meets. And it becomes obvious who the next president is going to be. There's a good argument to be made, Jack, that the January 6th joint session of Congress doesn't even need to happen. It's really just a ceremonial event at which the federal government acknowledges what the states have done, because the Constitution makes the states supreme in terms of a presidential election. So the only thing that's supposed to happen on January 6th is the Congress gets together and counts the electoral votes. And importantly, Pence is there not as a representative of the executive branch. The executive branch has nothing to do with this. Pence is there in his role as president of the Senate, which is a constitutional responsibility. So this is the first branch of government meeting to acknowledge the fact that the states have met, the Electoral College has met, and they, in a ceremonial, really ministerial way, count the votes. And if there's no issue about, like, you know, are there multiple slates that have been certified by the same state, then there's nothing for Congress to do but count. And in this instance, the states had all certified their votes. That was all done by December 8th. The Electoral College met December 14th, and it was done. This whole idea that January 6th was an occasion to undo that was inane, and it had no chance of working. It just was stupid.
Yeah. So it seems like, just a sort of grand takeaway from what you've been saying, like, we've got a situation here where obviously the left really wants to see Trump indicted, love to see Trump frog marched in an orange jumpsuit to somewhere, but is worried that Garland's not going to do it. And then Garland knows probably that he shouldn't do it, but doesn't want the entire left to blow up at him. So that it sort of speaks to the broader question or broader problem of all of these post-2020 efforts to get Trump on something, which is that it's actually kind of hard to get to nail him for a legal offense. It's easy to get him for a political offense, but that ship kind of already sailed, and we were not aboard it. So all that being said, what do you think is going to happen? Is Garland going to try to indict Trump on something, or is he just going to have to sort of bite his tongue and let the bad orange man roam free?
Well, I think that Garland, who is an institutionalist as far as the Justice Department is concerned, before Garland was a federal judge, he was a high-ranking Justice Department official in the Clinton administration. That's how I got to know him when I was prosecuting terrorism cases in New York. He was a very good Justice Department official, very efficient, understood of all the people you could talk to in the Clinton Justice Department about serious law and order stuff, he was one of the adults in the room. I really liked him. And then he was a federal judge for a long time. But he cares about the Justice Department as an institution. And I think that part of him will be screaming that this would be a mistake as long as they don't have enough evidence to prove that Trump committed a violent crime, which I don't think there's evidence of. The problem here, Jack, is that, you know, this goes to the broader point about the Biden administration. You know, they had this idea that he had this grandiose idea. He's going to be, you know, FDR reincarnated. They were going to deliver a big legislative agenda for the left and all that stuff. And he never had the votes for it. So they're very frustrated. They haven't gotten what they wanted out from him out of voting, out of climate, out of, you know, the million other things they want. He can spend a lot of money because of the way the Senate rules work, but they can't push a legislative agenda through, and they can't really push it through the administrative agencies either, because the courts are going to stop them. So they're very frustrated in what they can deliver to their base, and they feel like they need to deliver to their base. So what is Biden in a position to give the base that he doesn't need Congress for, and he doesn't have to worry about the courts on? The Justice Department. They can indict anyone. It's a completely unilateral exercise of discretion. It can't be checked by Congress. It can't be checked by the courts. They can file whatever lawsuits they want. Nobody can tell them what to do. So unfortunately for Garland, this is something that the Biden administration can deliver to the left that they don't need anyone else's help for. And I think if they're desperate enough that they think they need to appease their base, the fact that it will be bad for the institution of the Justice Department, and the fact that it will cause major deepening of the political rifts that exist in the country will be beside the point. This is something that that Garland can deliver for Biden. And, you know, I think just to take one last example, Garland knew that it was idiotic to send the FBI out to investigate parents for protesting against woke progressivism in the school curricula, right? But he did it anyway. He did it even though he had to know this was like one of the all-time stupidest things he ever did in his life. And the reason is it was something they could deliver the left. It was a bad idea, but they were under a lot of pressure to show that their hearts were in the right place. And I think that's going to, I fear that that will happen again here, because I don't think they have a good case against Trump. You're quite right. What they had was a political case against Trump. They've made, like, the January 6th committee, even with all of its failings, has underscored that there was an exquisite case to impeach Trump if the House Democrats had done a competent job and actually written articles of impeachment that matched the misconduct that Trump engaged in. That would have put a lot more pressure on Senate Republicans to vote not only to convict him on impeachment, but more importantly, to disqualify him from holding future office. And then we wouldn't be here. But they didn't do that. And the problem now is they're trying to use something that doesn't fit. They're trying to use criminal prosecution as a proxy for impeachment. And it not only doesn't do the job of impeachment, it will hurt the Justice Department and probably tear the country apart.
Great.
So let's do it.
Yeah, sounds like fun. So, okay, awesome. Now it's very nice to, I mean, it's just a benefit for me to be able to have Andy around here to explain these things to me. And now I hope that that the audience is now more enlightened about this matter than it was before. So moving on to another matter on which I could use some Andy McCarthy enlightenment. We had a couple days ago an attack. I mean, this is a sort of disturbing trend that there's been a sort of spate of violence or attempted violence on sitting members of or parts of our government. Attack on Lee Zeldin, a U.S. congressman from New York, a GOP candidate for New York governor. He was giving a speech last Thursday in Perrenton, New York, attacked by this guy, David Jacobonis, with sort of like a brass knuckles type thing that looked pretty dangerous. I mean, it looks like something that you don't want to be hit by. Zeldin was safe. Attacker was arrested, but then immediately re-released. But then now he's been, so that was kind of questionable. But now he's been charged by the feds with something else. So he is now, is he currently in prison somewhere?
He was supposed to have a detention hearing. He is in prison.
Okay.
Or at least was as of yesterday. He was supposed to have a detention hearing. I tried to find some reporting on it and couldn't find it this morning. So
unlike John Hinckley Jr., who is not in prison.
Right. Exactly. Right. Right. So, you know, look, what this goes to is the insanity of what has been made of the New York State criminal justice system, which is not a trivial matter because it was New York more than any other state that beginning in the 1990s adopted the practices that drove crime down to record lows over the next generation to the
point something where you have some experience and knowledge of.
Well, yeah, but this was really, I watched a lot of it from the federal side, but this was really a state phenomenon. I wish we could have taken more credit for it than we deserve, but really they changed their policies and they went to broken windows enforcement. I mean, it was Rudy who was the trailblazer here, and he had been my boss at the U.S. Attorney's Office for about 8 years before he became mayor in, I guess it was 93, 94. But they adopted this new intelligence-based policing, and it worked wonders. And the metric I always point out to people, Jack, is in 1990, there were 2,200 murders in New York City.
Wow.
In 2018, there were 289. Wow. I mean, that's how much, and that's just murder. This is like an overall trend with respect to violent crime. But year after year, I mean, when I grew up in the Bronx in the 60s and 70s, it was a commonplace that you would have somewhere between 1,500 and 2,000 murders every year. And they just, it just completely,
that was the classic, changed. 1970s dystopian era, New York City. That was the subject of all those movies.
Yep. There's a lot of them. All those Charles Bronson movies and, early Clint Eastwood movies that all came out of that, that era. But, tragically, New York, basically decided, and I think this is just a cycle of human nature, because historically it comes up again and again, where you're undone by your own success. Like crime goes down to the point where people don't have living memory of what it used to be like before crime went down, and they're vulnerable to being convinced that maybe it's not such a big problem after all. And we have too many people in jail, and there's too much prosecution, and we ought to ease off. And the progressives find their voice and it starts to resonate with people, and you reverse what you've been doing, never realizing that what you've been doing is what's giving you the prosperity that you have. So what they've done in New York, New York has always been an outlier in the rest of the country in that under its bail laws, you are not allowed to detain someone pretrial as a danger to the community. In the remaining 49 states and in the federal government, you can detain someone as a danger to the community on the basis of their criminal history and a finding by the judge that if you release them, they could, harm witnesses, bribe jurors, do all kinds of mayhem that would undermine the proceedings. Every other state has that. New York doesn't have it. It wasn't a problem in New York for the last generation or so, because if you committed a serious crime in New York, the judge could set bail, and you could set bail so high that a person couldn't make the bail and they were effectively detained anyway. In the racialist narrative of criminal justice that we now have in New York, what they said was the result of that is that too many people who are Black and brown end up being detained without bail, and they end up getting prosecuted and getting longer sentences, which is why they're disproportionately represented among the prison population. And we have to do something about this. So what they've done is you can't set bail in New York anymore for crimes that they don't regard as serious. And this includes even crimes like assault, arson, burglary, robbery, if they're committed at a low level and nobody really gets seriously injured. And the result of that is that, somebody if you commit a serious crime, or what people I think objectively would think was a serious crime, as long as no one gets hurt or hurt too badly, you're going to be released on your own recognizance, because there's only a handful of crimes now in New York that you can actually set bail for. So what happened with Lee Zeldin is, even though he's running for governor, he's a member of Congress, he was attacked in broad daylight in front of like a million people at a press covered event. Much like the 1970s, the guy who did it was released while the cops were still working on the paperwork for the arrest. Jeez. You know, I mean, that's how fast it happens. And the unique thing about Zeldin's case is, unlike almost everyone in New York, Zeldin is a member of Congress, the United States Congress. And as a result, he is covered. You know, if an ordinary New Yorker gets assaulted, there's nothing the feds can do about it. If you assault a member of Congress, there's federal law that says don't do that. So even though he got released in the state, and even though the state insanely charged him, I mean, this is as you described the assault, it was a serious assault with a serious weapon. The prosecutor in Monroe County charged it as an attempted assault. And I couldn't believe that when I saw it, because like you might have said it was an attempted murder, but it was an actual assault. It wasn't an attempted assault. I mean, the guy was out nothing flat. In the federal government, he's a member of Congress, and there's statutes that say you can't assault a member of Congress. So he was arrested on Saturday by the feds on that charge. He's looking at a potential of 20 years in prison on that charge, which would never have been the case in New York. I think the maximum sentence in New York for what he was charged with is 2 to 7 years, and he was not going to get that. In the federal government, where the sentencing guidelines apply, he'll get real time. In the federal government, bail will get set, because you can detain someone as a danger to the community, and the judge can always set a cash bail. So it's going to be a real prosecution. Now, it sounds to me like the guy's very disturbed. You know, he's an Iraq war veteran, which means he's combat trained, so that weapon was probably even more dangerous in his hands than it would be in the normal person's hands. But he was boozing all day, and apparently, you know, says that he didn't even know that who Zeldin was, or that he was a political person. He thought he, you know, convinced himself that he was saying something to attack veterans. In the meantime, like, Zeldin himself is also a veteran. So the guy seems like a lost soul, but it's a serious case, and it ought to be treated as a serious case. And if you care about people getting the kind of mental health medical treatment that they ought to get, that's much more apt to happen in the context of an actual prosecution than what happens in New York, which is you just release people and pretend that you don't have a problem.
Yeah, this is very interesting. Two things about this. It's funny, given what you were, or ironic, I guess, given how you were describing the way that New York was able to turn itself around originally, and it was not really the feds who were doing it. But now you've got a situation where it's actually better that this case is being handled at the federal level than at the state level, because the state has all this laxity about crime. And the other thing, you're talking about this cycle of crime with human nature. I think there's also just a simple fact that people sort of age out of it, in the sense that, like, lessons have to be constantly relearned by succeeding generations. I always think of AOC in this context, as someone who, she's just a handful of years older than me, someone who I'm sure grew up in taking for granted the safe New York City and had no idea what went into that, how it came to be that way. And now she looks around and is like, "Well, why do we have all of these strict laws and all of this police brutality? This is bad. We need to get rid of it all." And then crime starts going up, and then it's like, "Oh well." And then the people have to come out of the woodwork and be like, "Actually, police matter. Law enforcement matters. Can't believe I'm doing this again, you idiots. But yes, all of these things matter." Yeah.
You know, if you think about it, Rudy became mayor, I think, in 1993.
The year I was born.
So a lot of people in New York don't have any memory of anything that happened before Rudy. And, you know, obviously we don't make students of history like we used to, but people have no idea how bad things were from the late 60s until the until the 90s. It's like that New York has not, it may be coming back, but it hasn't existed in so long. It's out of the memory of people. They have, when you tell them how bad it can get, they look at you like you have three heads.
Yeah. And I definitely don't have three heads. I'm not a character in Total Recall or something. But anyway, these have been two darker items, I guess. And let's end. I don't know if I can call this a light item. Certainly not a Nash Review Editors Podcast light item. But as bad as the travails of Hunter Biden are, and as sort of effrontery to our justice system and to and likely indications of nepotistic dynastic political corruption, it's kind of recognizable in the sense that there's always in the presidential family, there's always a black sheep. Going back like to the beginning of the country, you have the sort of ne'er-do-well who decides like, oh, well, now that I'm proximate to power, I'm going to try to leverage this as best as I can. But so that the Hunter Biden stuff in that sense is recognizable. I mean, that doesn't make it any better. And in fact, there are Republicans in the Senate, Chuck Grassley and Ron Johnson, who have been trying to probe the exact extent of Hunter and the Biden family corruption as much as they can figure out. So, and Grassley, who found time between his periodic complaints about the proliferation of alien shows on the History Channel, sent a letter to the recurring theme of this podcast, Merrick Garland, and to Christopher Wray, sort of demanding more, accusing them of undermining this investigation. So, what is going on here? Are they correct? Is the FBI and DOJ stonewalling this, or are Grassley and Johnson sort of blowing smoke here?
I think this is real. And you know, I'm with you on the idea that Hunter is kind of the comic relief, but unfortunately, it can't be. You know, for the reasons we put in an editorial about the, I'd say in the last 2 weeks, it can't be dismissed on that basis because right. It looks like he's the vehicle for the Biden family profiting immensely, especially with respect to some shady foreign money on Joe's not only political influence, but you know, his contacts overseas, and they've cashed into a fairly well. I mean, I think I saw an NBC estimate that in a, like a 5 to 6 year period, Hunter raked in about $11 million, and that's not he's not the only one in the Biden family who profited in the Biden circle, I should say, because it's a little more expensive than just the family who profited from that. So anyway, Johnson and Grassley have been looking into this for some time. And even before there was a laptop, they were looking at a lot of interesting financial transactions in which foreign money was going into accounts that were controlled by, for example, Hunter Biden and Jim Biden, who's the president's brother. And a lot of it was flagged by American financial institutions, mostly, you know, domestic banks, as suspicious activity. Just like a brief aside to people, there are laws that control the movement of currency in and out of the country, and also the booking of cash transactions. And sometimes people structure their financial transactions in a way that's designed to defeat the bookkeeping, you know, the reporting rules. So what banks do when that happens and they detect it is they file what's called suspicious activity reports, where the common example is like with a cash transaction, you're supposed to file a currency transaction report if it's $10,000 or more. So if somebody goes to five banks and does five $2,000 transactions, or comes back to the same bank on five consecutive days with $2,000 to try to not file the $10,000 report, the bank will think that that's suspicious because it looks like behavior that's designed to defeat the reporting. So there were about 150 apparently suspicious transaction reports that were connected to Hunter Biden that Johnson and Grassley were looking at. And we know now that they had tons of money coming in from, you know, Chinese sources and apparently Kazakhstan and Russia and all these other places. So this looks to me, Jack, in the end, just like to try to summarize it quickly, it looks a lot like what the Hillary Clinton campaign appears to have done in connection with promoting the idea that Trump was colluding with Russia under circumstances where they really didn't have any proof that that was true, but they thought it would be a good thing to float. They thought it would be helpful. I think the Democrats, in connection with the 2020 election, thought that it would be effective to suggest that the Hunter stuff was the product of foreign disinformation, particularly Russian disinformation. So what happened here looks like a clever little two-step that they did in conjunction perhaps with the FBI. And the two FBI agents who are involved here are guys who have checkered pasts, to say the least. One of them is the is a guy named Tim Thebolt, who is the head of the Washington field office, who's already been referred to the Justice Department for investigation and discipline because he used his LinkedIn account to do political stuff and to trash Trump and trash the Republican administration and to promote himself.
To use LinkedIn, period.
Yeah, there you go. That's right. I don't know why I do. You know, do you get a million of these? Like, someone wants to join your LinkedIn network, and I'm like, how the hell do I even have a LinkedIn network?
But, yeah, LinkedIn's weird. One of the weird ones. Anyway, digression.
Yeah. So, digression. So, the other guy is this guy Auten. I forget his first name off the top of my head, but he was involved in the Trump Russia business. He was one of the agents who interviewed the sources for Christopher Steele's now infamous dossier. And, you know, the result of all that was that it was not reported back to the FISA court that, you know, there were major problems with the applications the Bureau had made. So these guys have checkered pasts. But here's what happens. The Democratic leadership in July of 2020, which is like Schumer, Pelosi, Mark Warner, and Adam Schiff, who are the heads of the intelligence committees, they go to the Bureau and they say, we think that we're threatened here in the upcoming election by foreign interference, and we want a briefing from the FBI, a defensive briefing that's going to give us what the landscape looks like with respect to foreign interference. And then 3 days later, Ron Wyden and what's Peters' first name? I can't remember. Gary Peters.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, but not very forgettable senator. That's a forgivable mistake.
Yes, but they happened to be at that time the ranking members of the committees that Grassley and Johnson run. And they write a similar letter to the FBI where they say, we think we're already being tormented by foreign interference. And they use some of Grassley and Johnson's evidence that they've amassed about Hunter Biden in order to suggest to the Bureau that maybe this could be a product of foreign interference, since there's so much foreign connection to it, that maybe this is foreign intelligence disinformation. So they write to the Bureau on, this happens like July 13th is the first contact and July 16th is the second. So what ends up happening is the Bureau has this guy Auten write an assessment based on what he's gotten from the senators that, oh yes, it looks like we're being threatened by foreign interference in the election. And apparently in completing this assessment, Auten brings in the agents who are investigating the Hunter Biden case. And they, according to the reporting from Grassley, they tell him, no, this isn't foreign disinformation. We can verify this stuff. Some of it we have verified. Some of it we could verify if we do other traditional forms of investigation. But this isn't disinformation. And I'm reminded to point out to people what I said back when the Hunter stuff first, the laptop first came out. And that is, the fact that you get information from even Russia doesn't mean it's disinformation in the sense of not being true. A lot of times Russia leaks stuff that is true that they think will be harmful. And what I have always told people is, in my career, I've taken information from very shady people, including, terrorists and mafia hitmen and fraudsters. And You can take information from anybody. The issue is, like, can you go out and corroborate it and verify it and then figure out what it all means? And in that course of that, you try to figure if you're being rolled or not, but you still take the information. So just because you say something came from Russia, that doesn't mean it's suddenly, you know, radioactive and you can't consider whether it's true or not, which is what the Democrats seem to be suggesting here. You know, if it's from Russia, it must be disinformation. So anyhow, Auten writes this assessment that basically says that you can dismiss all this stuff as Russian disinformation. And then the Bureau brings these leaders in Congress, including Grassley and Johnson, in August of 2020 to a briefing that Grassley and Johnson don't ask for. This was asked for by the Democrats. And Grassley said this was completely gratuitous. There was no need for this briefing. But the Democrats used the occasion of the briefing to leak to the media afterwards that the Bureau thinks that we're facing Russian disinformation. And that becomes the germ which results in all of the Hunter Biden stuff in the run-up to the election being dismissed as Russian disinformation, when in fact now, you know, we now know that these transactions really were suspicious. The banks really did say they were suspicious. Hunter really did have this laptop. The information on the laptop really is Hunter's. It really is disturbing. But, you know, for the months in the lead up to the 2020 election, I think it gave them a real opportunity that they used to a fare thee well to dismiss something that would have been, in a different kind of election, it might have been a very controversial issue. I don't know if it would have been a decisive issue, but it would have been an important issue. But they were able to sweep it under the rug at the critical time.
Yeah, well, Andy, I just can't believe that you're skeptical of Hunter Biden's expertise in the energy sector. Can't you? But you don't think that all these shady foreign governments are seeking out his what? Joe call him a genius or something at one point?
Yeah, well, you know, look, if you told me, Jack, that if you wanted to invest $3.8 billion in a cobalt mine, I would say Hunter was your go-to guy. But you're right. When it comes to, you know, oil and gas, I'm very suspicious.
Yeah, right. Oh, anyway, that's for anyone who accuses me of being a Hunter Biden shill, this is called sarcasm, people, so get used to it. But anyway, Grassley concludes his letter by accusing the DOJ and FBI of possibly being institutionally corrupt to their very core. And if that's the case, then that raises lots of questions. But the main one, I guess, that's germane to what we're discussing now is what's going to happen next. Like, are we going to? I think people are searching for a sort of smoking gun moment in the sense that, like, we find out that Joe Biden was deeply implicated in a lot of this, which it seems like he in fact was. I mean, we're getting evidence that he was at the very least a conduit for some of these relationships, which is deeply questionable. But will it ever be enough for him to be, or at least Hunter to be, charged with some crime? That's my question. I'm no defender of the man, but like, what's the likeliest thing to happen here, you think?
Well, I'm more worried about what happens with DOJ and the FBI than Hunter, but I do think with Hunter, what I've always thought, and this is just cynical, I guess, but that's what you get at my age after all this time. But I think what they're going to do with Hunter is they're going to try to plead him guilty to a tax violation and maybe even a gun charge in connection with the false statement that he made to get the firearm. He, you know, you have to check when you're filling out those forms, as Charlie has pointed out a number of times, you have to wrestle with the question that asked you whether you're a user of illegal narcotics. And we now have not only Hunter's history of using illegal narcotics, but it looks like there's a video of him like 5 days after he gets the gun waving around the gun with one of his escorts.
Jeez.
Who's an escort?
Oh, man.
So, you know, I think that what they may do is plead him out to that, which, by the way, if they do that, that will cut away and insulate the most interesting part of the investigation, which is the president influenced by foreign money? Has he been compromised by a lot of, you know, millions of dollars that have gone into the into the Biden family coffers? And does that explain some of the policy strangeness that we've seen, for example, with respect to China? But I think if they do that, Jack, it'll be a little bit of theater where Biden will be able to say, see, I didn't interfere with the Justice Department. The Justice Department will be able to hold its head up and say, see, we investigated the president's son without fear or favor. And Hunter will plead guilty and get no jail time. It'll be like a, you know, be a minor tax case. He's already got some sugar daddy out in California, this Hollywood lawyer who's given him a $2 million loan that he's used to get himself right with the IRS. So I don't think he owes them money anymore. And even though the gun thing is serious, nobody gets prosecuted for that. So what, you know, his lawyers will be able to say is it would be selective prosecution, not only to have him plead guilty for it, but to the thought of sending him to jail for something that the government doesn't ordinarily even prosecute would be wrong. And I think, you know, some judge will listen to all that and say, yeah, you're right. And they'll give Hunter like supervised release and probation, and that'll be it. And everybody will say, see, we performed honorably here. But what will really have happened is a big tarp will have been thrown over the most interesting part of the investigation, which is the foreign money. So that's what I think will happen with Hunter. As far as the FBI and the Justice Department are concerned, the likelihood is the Republicans are going to win the midterms and they're going to have subpoena power. And I think that I wouldn't be surprised if once that happens, a lot of people currently at the Justice Department and the FBI decide that maybe it's time to start spending more time with their families.
The classic, because, yes.
Well, these investigations are going to be... The Republicans, you know, what I have said from the beginning with respect to the January 6th committee is, hey, Democrats, what goes around comes around.
Yeah.
And if you're going to smash every norm known to man in doing these scorched earth investigations at Trump, don't think that this isn't going to come back around.
Right.
And it's coming.
The it man for coming. All seasons thing about the country planted thick with laws. And if you cut down all the trees looking for the devil, what are you going to do when the devil turns around? But anyway, yes. So you're describing, when it comes to Hunter Biden, you're describing essentially what the CIA would call a modified limited hangout, a release of some right. information to prevent the release right. of the even more incriminating information.
Exactly.
But the so I don't know. If I were a scion of a presidential or vice presidential family, I would simply not do deals with shady foreign governments. But that's just me. So anyway, who knows what I would do in the actual situation. I like to think I wouldn't.
If your escorts were depending on you.
Yes, my escorts. Right. So anyway, thank you, Andy. I feel very enlightened. It has been a real like privilege just for me to be able to ask you about these things that are often complicated to understand, because in many cases, it just seems like lawyers designing things so that they can talk to each other about them. But I feel enlightened, and I hope the audience feels the same. But that is all the time we have. So thank you again. This podcast has been produced by the incomparable, the unparalleled, the magnificent, I added a few adjectives there, Sarah Schutte. Thank you for everyone for listening and for putting up with my substitute host duties. I hope that at the very least I made it tolerable. And if you absolutely hated it, Rich is going to be back soon and you'll never hear from me again. And of course, thank you, Andy McCarthy, for making this podcast stay listenable despite my subpar hosting abilities. And I guess that's it. So,
Jack, come on. It's not every week we get from Shakespeare to Thomas More in one episode. I mean,
that's true. Yeah, maybe the bar's been set high. Bring it on, Rich. Do your worst. Anyway, that's all.